Mr. John Pear, National Federation of the Blind, Executive Director for Advocacy and Policy. And we also have with him Mr. Jeff Kellogg. And then we'll discuss NFB process of voting rights and how members can take action in the resolution process. As you see, it's with things on legislation being proposed like this throughout the country, it is very vital that we know how to take action within the confines of our organizations. And Mr. John Pear, he will kind of share with us on how we coordinate this, these types of actions and how they become, priorities. So, Mr. John Pear, the floor is yours.
Great. Thank you, Lee. Thank you so much for, getting off over a little cough. Thank you for inviting me to speak, and I'll go over to Jeff in a few minutes. Jeff is one of our government affairs specialists, and he's the one working on our voting efforts together with Luann Blake. All right. So, now maybe I'm going to start from some high level and get to more detail. One of the things Lee said to begin with was a little bit about how we pick what we issues we work on, especially at the federal level. The methodology for doing that at the state level is very similar, except that you do it affiliate by affiliate. All right. So at the national level, there's first thing very important to remember is that the National Convention of the National Federation of Blind is the supreme authority of the NFB. And so our resolutions are what determine our policy. President Riccobono, president of the National Federation of the Blind, will sometimes say, you know, that's his to-do list. That's our policy determined by our National Convention. Anyone can submit a resolution for consideration to the resolution's chair, which is currently Sharon Maneki. And she usually puts out an announcement to remind people the deadlines associated with that, which is currently, I think, 30 days, maybe before the National Convention, specifically the resolutions meeting at National Convention. That has to be submitted. We usually do some review to fix any possible technical errors so that the resolution doesn't fail due to a technical error, which usually the authors appreciate, but no edit is forced on them. And then the resolution will come up at the resolutions committee meeting. And if it passes there, it goes to the full floor. And if it passes there, it becomes our policy. Failing to pass a resolution doesn't mean the opposite. If you fail to pass a resolution, it means really nothing. It just didn't pass. But when you pass a resolution, it's now considered our policy. All of our resolutions, certainly the current ones and going back 30 or 40 years, maybe all the way back to 1940, are posted on our website. They're always published in the Braille monitor because we want to make sure that these people are aware of our resolutions. So we put them on the website. We put them on the Braille monitor. Of course, the Braille monitor is available also on our website and available on NFB Newsline. And then depending on who they're directed to, say they're directed to the Department of Education, then we would typically mail the resolution with a cover letter to the Secretary of Education, or if it's directed to Congress, we would mail it maybe to Speaker Pelosi or Majority Leader Schumer or to Mitch McConnell or to McCarthy, the minority leader on the House side. Kind of depends. Where some are oriented to companies, sometimes tech companies, so we send it to them and so forth. So we make sure that those get distributed, not just within the NFB, but they get distributed to the target audience, depending on what we are asking for. So that's that policy portion. In addition, throughout the year, at every affiliate convention, President Riccobono either attends that or sends a representative who talks to members, to the affiliate leadership and to members, and is always reports back to President Riccobono. What do our members want? What are they saying? What's of interest to them? You're welcome to write President Riccobono anytime you want. His email is Office of the President, all one word, Office of the President at NFB.org. And of course, you're also welcome to write me, but I'm not the president, but you're welcome to write me. My email is J P A R E at nfb.org. So I want to make sure you know that the lines of communication are open with ideas that you might have, and that goes for all of our members. So we're all year long collecting ideas about what are the problems that we need to try to solve to improve the lives of blind people. And of course, do as we would say, live the lives we want. This comes to kind of a focal point in the, at the national board meeting that usually occurs on or about Thanksgiving weekend. Typically right now the schedule is typically the weekend after Thanksgiving. The national board then makes a final determination based on a number of factors, which I can talk a little bit about what issues should be involved in the upcoming Washington seminar. And then they make a final recommendation, they being the national board, to President Riccobono. And then President Riccobono makes the final decision. And then we, at that point, we have the issues, and they're normally announced a week or two after that. Sometimes there's some research that needs to be done, and we start working on fact sheets, and we get the fact sheets on the web as quickly as we can, typically the first week of January, so that people now are aware of those. One, I would say, thing I want to emphasize is, while certain issues we think will benefit from the Washington seminar focus, don't think for a second that that's the only thing we work on. Right now, the Washington seminar issues were the Access Technology Affordability Act, which I won't try to describe all these because I think it'll take up too much time. So I'm going to kind of assume you know that, or you can look at the website. So the Access Technology Affordability Act, Medical Device Non-Visual Accessibility Act, the 21st Century Website and Application Accessibility Act, and the Transformation of Competitive Integrated Employment Act. Those four issues. Then the, and they're not in an, I just, they're not, that's not a priority order. It just helps me remember them to have an order to them. So I order them, and I encourage other people to order them, but only so it helps us stay organized. It's not a priority. They're all a priority. And then the other ones, they're also a priority. I would say the next one I like to keep organized is voting. That's both at the federal and state level, and I'm going to come back to that. Then we're doing Social Security, both the earnings cliff for SSDI, the changing the waiting period. We've been talking a lot, you know, we have to wait 5 months before we start collecting. If you are eligible for SSDI and you're determined eligible, you still have to wait 5 more months after your eligibility date to start collecting. That's ridiculous. We shouldn't have to do that. And then there's some of the reach back on the penalties are absolutely horrible. And we have a national resolution on that should be changed with a recommendation on how we should do that. So we're working the Social Security issues, working on transportation issues. One of the ones we're spending a lot of time right now, because it's so much at the stage it's at, is the restrictions with guide dogs on airlines. That's one. Two would be the number of times that people with guide dogs are refused access to rideshare, Uber and Lyft, and trying to figure out how we do something about that. The very poor performance of paratransit, another issue. Lack of mass transit, another issue. Some problems we're having with Amtrak. Might not be as much as an issue in Indiana, because I don't know that you have so much Amtrak service, but it's quite an issue in some other places. And then maybe more, very positive thing, trying to make sure that fully automated vehicles will also be something that we can operate, that they're non-visually accessible in some of the work that we're doing. Those are all things we're doing under the general topic of transportation. The some of the other kind of highly specialized things is some things we're doing with to try to prevent rest area commercialization that would dramatically impact and negatively impact our Randolph Shepherd vendors. That's probably the largest number of Randolph Shepherd vendors as far as the type of location is at rest stops, and we're working hard to make sure that those are protected and those Randolph Shepherd vendors can do well. There's, I didn't bring my list right with, there's several others, but that gives you an idea of the, I do remember the other two. Education, I can't know how I can mention that after that great presentation about that problems with that bill, which very big problems. And this is the Individuals with Disability Education Act reauthorization that's being considered. This is the bill that creates the idea that you have to, that not the idea. It creates the law and the requirement that people with disabilities have to receive a full and appropriate public education. It also creates that you have to do it in the least restrictive environment. Two things that we care a lot about, we at the National Federation of Blind: free and appropriate public education in the least restrictive environment. Also, higher ed reauthorization is coming up, and we want to be focused on that to try to improve opportunities in higher education. The I use the term reauthorization. These laws, typically like IDEA or the Higher Education Act, are every 5 to 10 years renegotiated and updated. And so this is an opportunity for us to make things better, and certainly to make sure they don't get worse. So the reauthorizations are, it's very important that we pay attention to those. And they're a little cyclical in that, for right now, for example, there's very little work being done on the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act reauthorization. This is at the federal level, so we don't need to put so much attention into that. When that starts to move, that will become a top issue for us. Same with higher ed reauthorization. All right, now some of the things you might wonder, what have we been doing in terms of some of the, especially the federal level voting? And maybe touching on the state level, Jeff really is the best person to talk about that. So turning it over to you, Jeff.
Thank you, John. Before I get into what we're doing at the given moment, I want to mention two principles at the NFB that we advocate for in general when it comes to voting. The first one is, as many of you are aware of, especially during the past few years, remote voting has really caught momentum in the sense that a lot of states are, permitting it, and people are able to vote remotely and not in a polling place. And at the NFB, our policy is with remote voting is, pretty straightforward. A blind person should be able to vote remotely, both privately and independently. And in order to do that, there's a process called electronic delivery and electronic return. Delivery is where you would have the ballot delivered to you, whether it's through a PDF or a portal or whatever the mechanism may be, but it'll be delivered to your home electronically, where you're able to access the ballot. And then also when you have the ballot, you're able to mark it, cast it, and also verify who you voted for, all in the process while you're returning the ballot. So those two components are, that component is very important. From the beginning process, we want to make sure that everyone's allowed to, privately and independently register, mark, cast, and verify, as I mentioned, your ballot. So with electronic delivery and return, that's a key principle we look for with remote voting. Now, we understand that not everyone has the means or the bandwidth or whatever, the mechanisms to vote remotely. So in-person voting is still a high priority as well. And when it comes to in-person voting, the Help America Vote Act that was passed in the early 2000s permitted that each polling location has a ballot marking device. And, ballot marking devices, as helpful as they've been, and with the Help America Vote Act ensuring that there's at least one in each polling place, they still come with their flaws. One of those being, oftentimes, these devices aren't set up from the beginning of the election day. Mm-hmm. The poller will go into the polling location and the poll workers won't even have it set up. And when a blind voter comes in, they go, they hit the panic button. They think, oh, we got to set this up now. And it shouldn't be that case. It should be set up when the polls open, whether it's, 7 a.m. or 8 a.m., whatever the time is that the polls open, those devices should be operational at that point. So that's the first part. Secondly, we want to make sure that the poll workers are properly trained on these devices. So, if a blind user needs assistance with it, or if there's a glitch in the system that needs to be corrected, or if anything that would happen with the polling with the ballot marking device, we want to make sure that the poll workers properly train and how to use them. And then lastly, because there's only one ballot marking device, and it's often only used when a blind or print disabled voter enters the polling location. They print a ballot that's in different size and texture than a hand marked paper ballot that is in size and texture. So what this does, it doesn't provide secrecy to the ballot. So if you were the one blind person who went into that particular precinct and used the ballot marking device, and you printed your ballot out that way, and everyone else in that precinct is using hand-marked paper ballots, it's going to be very distinguishable to tell that, you know, this one ballot came from the one person who used the ballot marking device. And then they're going to be able to see who you voted for and everything like that. And the secrecy of your vote is no longer confidential. You know, it's the confidentiality of the vote is pretty much gone at that point. So those are the principles that we're trying to correct when we speak about in-person voting, to ensure that poll workers are, the machines are set up from the start of the day, poll workers are properly trained, and that there's a secrecy of the ballot. And one of the solutions to this is have more people, whether they're disabled or not disabled, use the ballot marking devices. This will make sure that the machines are operational from the beginning, because they're gonna be expecting everyone to use them. Poll workers will be more familiar with them as more people are using them, and they'll become better equipped to manage them. And there'll be more ballots printed from from the ballot marking devices, therefore providing some secrecy to the ballot for the voters that are using them. So these are the two principles, whether it's in-person or remote voting, that we advocate for, whether it's on a federal level or on a state level. And back in the beginning of 2021, Congress was looking at passing voting reform legislation in the form of H.R. 1 or S. 1. And we at the National Federation of the Blind, we were very persistent in our advocacy efforts to include the provisions that I mentioned, to make sure that in-person voting contained the components that I mentioned, as well as remote voting. And we were advocating to the extent that we actually got an amendment into H.R. 1. Unfortunately, it was removed and a little bit watered down towards the end, that it didn't really contain the provisions that we would like it to contain. And H.R. 1 ended up passing, and it went over to the Senate, where the Senate was debating it. And currently in the Senate, for those that are following politics, or for those that aren't, There's a stalemate when it comes to this particular issue with voting, and the bill required a 60 votes in the Senate in order to pass. And currently there's only about 50 votes that they can garner for this particular bill. So we, in that sense, there's a stalemate on the federal level that's not going to allow the passage of this bill. Now, that doesn't mean we still weren't trying to advocate for the provisions that we wanted in this bill up until the last moment, until the bill ultimately didn't pass, because you never know in that given sense it could pass. They could find the 10 votes somewhere to make sure this legislation passes. So, we at the National Federation of the Blind, we're still advocating up to the last moment to get these provisions in there, whether it was electronic ballot delivery and return or the provisions that I had mentioned about in-person voting. Unfortunately, we were not able to include them in that larger piece of legislation, the For the People Act. Now, Congress is still working to try to get voting rights legislation passed. They've come up with a couple different bills. And most recently, what they have done is they combined two bills together. They combined the Freedom to Vote Act, which is basically the For the People Act, just with a different name. And also the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act. And they took both of these bills and put them together in what they're calling the Freedom to Vote John Lewis Act. And, you know, we're still advocating to get the provisions that we would like to see, for in-person and for remote voting in this particular piece of legislation. Unfortunately, none of these bills are going to be passing in the Senate. It's just a stalemate right now, which leads me to my next point. Just because there's a stalemate on the federal level doesn't mean we give up. We still advocate at the federal level, but we also have to understand that if legislation's not going to move on a federal level, then we need to go to the state level, because there's still going to be elections happening at the end of this year. And we want to make sure that blind voters can vote both privately and independently. So Liam, my colleague Luann Blake and I, we have been working with various states at the state level to advocate for these provisions of remote voting and in-person voting on a state-by-state basis. And, you know, to the extent that we, even with particular states, we have weekly or bi-weekly meetings with them on their progress and what they need to do and what the next steps are to ensure that voters in their blind and print disabled voters in their states can vote both with privacy and with the independence. So that's what we've been working on. And, you know, by all means, we'd be more than happy to work with, you know, Indiana and see where you guys are at. You know, we write usually to the Board of Election. We try to engage with them or the Secretaries of State. There's different ways though that legislation could be passed on a state level. You know, Massachusetts and North Carolina, they were able to get electronic ballot delivery and return through court orders. They use the cases basically that since UOCAVA voters that are voters, that's military and overseas voters, were using this system to vote overseas remotely with electronic delivery and return, that it was discriminatory that voters with disabilities were not able to use that same practice or that same method. So in those two particular states in 2020, they were granted the right to vote remotely using electronic ballot delivery and return. Now, other states, they pass legislation and go through the state senate and the state delegation, and then all the way up to the governor to pass legislation. And Colorado is one of those states that has recently done that. And the legislators that were advocating for these particular bills, they were getting pushback. But they, you know, we educated them on the issue and why some of the resistance they were getting wasn't what the people that were opposing it thought it was. So we kind of gave them ways to navigate the opposition and work in a way that they could get this legislation passed and ultimately into law. And now Colorado is able, voters that are blind and print disabled in Colorado can vote they can vote remotely using electronic ballot delivery and return. So, you know, we're always trying to be crafty in a way that our angle is just to make sure that blind voters can vote in that manner. Like I said, whether it's through a court order, whether it's through legislation, you know, you name it, we're just trying to get it done and we're going to use anything at our disposal to do so.
All right. I really certainly appreciate your presentations there. Are there any questions? You can please raise your hand and ask any questions on this issue.
Just as a point of privilege here, since there is no hand raised right now. Jeff, I have a question. What were some of the concerns expressed by the legislature in terms of the concerns that they have with remote voting?
Sure, yeah. So the concerns, the opposition that we usually face when it comes to electronic delivery and return is security concerns. Is it safe? Can it be done in a safe manner that it won't be hacked? You know, we've been using this sort of technology with especially UOCAVA voters, as I mentioned, military and overseas voters that have been using this since about 2008. And there haven't been any cases of fraud or, you know, election tampering or hacking. Of course, there's no proof that it's happened. But, you know, we want to make sure we're reasonable. We understand that, you know, there has to be security in our elections. And when we talk to IT specialists and election folks, Luann and I do, there actually are ways to do this in a safe manner that provides a blind and print disabled person a right to still vote privately and independently. And and we try to describe them. There's different portals. There's encrypted PDFs. You know, whenever they bring up that there's security concerns, the first thing I look at is, well, what ways does their state allow them to vote? Because sometimes when they say this, their state will allow them to vote by fax. And fax is not safe at all. Fax can be very tampered with. It can be, you know, it's not a safe way to cast a ballot per se. So when I, you know, hear their concerns, sometimes I look, you know, where are they actually coming from on this? Cause we want to make sure we reach a resolution with them or a compromise with them to say, like, look, we understand we too want to make sure that, you know, no one's vote is tampered with and that it's safe and secure. That's a legit, concern. But there are ways to do it. So you know, especially like in Colorado, when we were facing pushback from some of the folks that were saying it can't be done in a way that's safe and secure, we had to have experts come in as well saying, yes, it can, and here's how, and explain to the legislators and explain to the Board of Election how it could be done and how other states are doing. Because actually, there are six states right now, six or seven states, I should say, that are voting this way for voters with disabilities that are allowing electronic delivery and return.
Jeff, maybe just throw in that the opposition, the security, sometimes you call them the security hawks, can be really relentless. So there can be some very substantial opposition. So I don't want to leave people thinking that this is easy. It can be quite challenging. And some of the states we have not yet been, you know, many states we haven't been successful. We're not stopping, but it's challenging. Would you agree with that, Jeff?
Yeah, because the term we use, security hawks or security personnel, it all goes by theory. Because obviously, as I mentioned, there haven't been any cases where there's been any hacking or tampering or, you know, anything of that nature. So it all goes to the theory. And when you bring up a theory, could it be hacked? Could this happen? I mean, you could bring up a theory for almost any election. Could someone, you know, go into a polling location and throw in a bunch of hand marked paper ballots? Theoretically, I guess they could. Is it likely? Probably not. We're always working ourselves against things of that nature, and we have to prove to them, sure, anything, I guess, could happen in theory per se, but we want to make sure that the probability of that theory is very low to the point where it's not going to mess up an election results.
All righty. Are there any other questions before we move on?
This is Michael Loff. I wanted to ask if you ever looked at like the Australian model where the public in general and the blind community, they've been able to vote online or via their telephone since 2010.
No, I wasn't aware of the Australian model. I know there's several countries. The examples I always often hear are countries in Eastern Europe that were former parts of the Soviet Union that vote using electronic delivery and return. And typically people, you know, you would think that those would be the countries that perhaps Russia would like to hack if they were going to hack anyone. And typically those countries have very low fraud cases and very low election tampering. So, I mean, I think cases like that prove that even in, you know, different countries, like you mentioned, Australia too, that this can be done. And, you know, even through an international basis where other countries are trying to influence their elections.
I guess I had a follow-up question. You mentioned that there are ways to protect it similar to the military and what folks overseas have been doing for many years. Is there somewhere, if we are advocating for the electronic, I mean, the remote voting here in the state of Indiana, and we want to provide that information, is that available to us?
Yeah, absolutely. What we could do is, Luann and I, we usually have what we could do is send you the legislation that other states have, mm-hmm. who have electronic ballot delivery and return have mm-hmm. used. Colorado is one of our gold standards right now because how they worked with the legislative process. If you want to take, you know, that we always like to go the legislative route first,
yes.
try to work with the state. So we'd be more than happy to send you some of the bill texts and what they have done in Colorado to move forward with that.
That sounds like that would be a great start here in the state of Indiana. And I know here in Indiana, we go, they want to go county by county on how we use the voting processes, which makes it kind of difficult with 90 or so counties. So that goes comes directly from the Secretary of State that we need to contact here. And I'm sure that our president, Diane Graves, wouldn't mind taking a look into this endeavor. And
I'm Brown.
Okay, Ron Brown, go ahead.
Yes, sir. guys, we had this issue at our state convention about 2 years ago. If you guys remember, the American Council for the Blind, the National Federation of the Blind, the Secretary of State's office all got together, and we wrote up a proposal along with disability rights, wrote up a proposal about voting rights, and we had the team that came in, I believe they was at our national convention. They spoke about accessible voting machines and things of that. And they came and spoke at our convention as well. So we have that information, and if you need us to send it back out, we can.
Thank you very much, Ron Brown.